President Kennedy had hoped to keep us out of direct involvement, and we think of him as the father of special forces, the Green Berets, advisors that would go in and help the indigenous folks of their own country help themselves. And lesser known is that the Air Force stood up a unit called the Air Commandos, which were sort of the equivalent of the Green Berets in the Air Force. South Vietnam had been supplied with Sky Raiders as early as 1960 and became the second largest operator of A-1s in the world. And the Air Force took over from the Navy working with the South Vietnamese in the early 60s flying missions using the E model. That's a two-seat version of this airplane where a U.S. pilot and a Vietnamese pilot could fly together.
Where would those pilots train, the South Vietnamese pilots? I mean, as long and detailed and deep a process as that was, where would they train?
The short answer is many of them came to America and did flight training in the States and then went back to Vietnam to serve. That joint flying only lasted a couple years. After the Gulf of Tonkin incident, America then took on a frontline role in Vietnam and flew the multi-place A-1E single pilot. Those airplanes were used up, and by this time, into the mid to late 60s, jet technology did catch up, and the Navy was now able to build their ship squadrons using A-4 Skyhawks, A-7 Corsair IIs, and the single-seat Skyraiders like R-606 and H model were now surplus, if you will. And the Air Force said, boy, we'll take all you'll give us. And they stood up four squadrons of single-seat, mostly single-seat
Skyraiders.
So where
would they fly out of?
Well, three of the squadrons were in Thailand, and one was in Vietnam. The airplanes did a variety of missions, everything from forward air control, armed reconnaissance, close air support for troops, more recently declassified support of Green Beret special operations teams, and then finally the most well-known mission, the search and rescue mission where they used the call sign Sandy, went in to protect downed pilots and then protect the helicopters that went in to pick up those downed pilots. Under President Nixon and the Vietnamization program, we needed to reduce our footprint in Vietnam and began a slow withdrawal. So piecemeal remaining Sky Raiders were handed over to the South Vietnamese. And by the end of 1972, we had stopped operating, Americans had stopped operating Sky Raiders in South Vietnam. And the Vietnamese were fighting on their own until the fall of South Vietnam in 1975. And the last part of the story really is that many of us have seen the Discovery Channel footage that when South Vietnam fell and the tanks rolled in on the embassy in the south, in Saigon, folks clamored to escape, mostly using helicopters to fly out to the ships offshore, and the footages of the decks being cleared, helicopters being pushed over the side to make room for more. Less documented was the escape of fixed-wing airplanes. Many of them went over to Thailand, and R-606 was used by a South Vietnamese pilot.
So why were these airplanes sent over to Thailand?
Thailand provided an ideal place for the Sky Raiders and the Jolly Green Rescue Helicopters to base out of because of the proximity of what's called the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Not just one trail, but really a network of thousands of paths and roadways that work down around Vietnam. And on one of the maps that you see there, you see that Vietnam is a very narrow country, and our forces in Vietnam formed what you would call a roadblock. And what do we do when you come up against a roadblock? You go around it. And therefore, the war spilled over into Laos and Cambodia. And that proximity of our bases in Thailand allowed us to operate and fight what they called the secret war, stopping the flow of men and material from North Vietnam through those neighboring countries into South Vietnam.
So how many hundreds or how many airplanes were parked over there to keep them from the North Vietnamese?
I would estimate the number is probably 50 or 60. I know 11 of them were Sky Raiders, and four of them, Roger and another pilot named Jack Drummond, were able to save.
So Roger, there's the backgrounder on all of this, which, by the way, is one of the best brief backgrounds about the Vietnam War I've ever heard. That was awesome. Roger, yeah. You know, this is part of what we do here. We're trying to present some of this history, because I guess most of you, if you were born when that was going on, you were awfully young. And so one of our goals is to not only honor veterans, which is the major reason we're here, but to try to refresh people's memories or give them some memory about who did what to make sure that we could be here today and live the lives we lead. And we honor these veterans every day in every way. So, Roger, you're up.
Thank you. And thank all of y'all for coming out here in this hot sun to listen to a little bit of history. When I started out in the pilot training, I wanted to fly the A-1 terribly so, but we didn't have any left. So I took a C-123 for 1 year tour in Saigon. Quickly volunteered for a concurrent tour to get into the A-1, and it worked out great. I flew the A-1 out of NKP, and towards the end of that tour...
What's NKP?
Nakhon Phnom. That's where we had our A-1 station. Towards the end of that tour, and this will bring you up to speed of us going to Utapau to get these airplanes, General Adderholt had contacted some of the A-1 people and said, I need some T-28 advisors. If y'all want to do that, I'll send you to the Defense Language Institute to study Thai for a year and then back over to work for him. I had come back and was going to work as a T-28 advisor when he introduced me to the Stole Porter, which the Thais had just acquired, and I became an advisor for that. This year is 73, and then we had 74, and then in 75 is when South Vietnam fell. During the 73-74 time frame, General Adderholt was working behind the curtain, so to speak, with the ambassador in Cambodia and the one in Vietnam. We had given them, the South Vietnamese, most of our airplanes in the Vietnamization, and they had become the fourth largest air force, so over 2,000 airplanes in the world. Things were going south for them, and same way with the Khmer Rouge, which was approaching into Cambodia. General Adderholt came up with a plan to get everybody out. My partner in crime, and I can't quite see the slides back there, but if they bring up Jack Drummond, he's the one that worked with me. General Adderholt had called him and called me and said, y'all had flown A-1s before, I need you to help me out. So Cambodia was about to fall, and they did fall back in early part of April. And there was about 60 or 97 airplanes came out of Cambodia, mostly T-28s, into Utapau. Now, set the stage here. You had four nations, four air forces at Utapau at one time. Once Saigon fell and the South Vietnamese Air Force came into Utapau, we had the U.S. Air Force that had B-52s still there. We had the Royal Thai Air Force. We had the Cambodian Air Force and the South Vietnamese Air Force. And nobody could hardly talk to anybody. It was a Wild West show. Wow. Beyond imagination.
Wow.
So my partner in crime was Jack Drummond. He had a great background, although not in combat in the A-1. He had one at Eglin Air Force Base. He was a weapons tester. He worked directly for General Adderholt. That was one of the reasons General Adderholt, when he went over to Southeast Asia, he took Jack Drummond with him because he trusted him. So once he had Jack Drummond in country and I was in country and Cambodia fell, he had called me and told me, he said, I need you to go down to Utapau, look things over. I'm understanding that the South Vietnamese are going to try to come out of there fairly quickly, and they did on April the 29th. Before they came out, he sent me down to a little field, and it's on one of the maps. I can't quite see him, David. But anyway, there's a small grassy strip next to Cambodia called Trat, T-R-A-T. He said, check that out, because a lot of the airplanes coming out of Cambodia and South Vietnam are not going to have gas, like especially the UH-1s and the O-1s, and they're going to need to land. So I went down there. I found a 3,000, 4,000-foot strip. I checked it out. It was okay. I got back to Adderholt, and I said, you can tell them through your channels that there is a strip short of Utapau. Utapau was further to the west. So when Cambodia came out, it was kind of phenomenal. General Adderholt designed the ops plan for them to leave. They literally loaded their T-28s in Phnom Penh with Mark 82s. And in doing so, they put all their families on a bus to go west to a place called Battamban. Once the families were there, the T-28s took off. They bombed the Khmer Rouge. They RTB'd into Battamban. They picked up their families and put them in the back seat of the T-28, loaded up again with Mark 82s, wow, and went back out to the Khmer Rouge, bombed the Khmer Rouge, and then returned into Thailand to land. Now that's the way it all happened, and that was because Atterholt lined it out for them exactly what to do. So he not only saved their families, but he did two strikes prior to them evacuating out to Utapau.
And the families were in the back seat of T-28s on bombing missions?
As many as a wife and two or three kids in the back seat of a T-28.
God.
The whole story of this evacuation, whether it's Cambodia or Vietnam, is unbelievable. We had A-37s landing with a pilot and four people in the right seat. We had C-47s designed for 30 or 40 people landing with 150 Vietnamese people in there. It was a Wild West show, believe me. So I had trot set up for them, and we were evacuating people out. And as we were getting them off the helicopters that would land, I was trying to check things out and see who was coming in and all, because we didn't know who was on the helicopters. And what was meaningful to me was, there was an elderly lady got off of the helicopter. She was in her Ao Yai, Vietnamese Ao Yai. She was about, according to my interpreter, pilot, Vietnamese pilot, he went and talked to her. She was over 90 years old. And she was carrying a plastic bag in her hands wrapped up like this, and she had tied a knot in it. And most of you or any of you that's been in Asia know that the Asian people carry a lot of things, food and everything, in these plastic bags. Well, she had a clear plastic bag that was filled with water. I said, well, what's in there? He came back and he said she got out of Vietnam with her goldfish.